Welcome to Teaming Up Conversations, the podcast. I'm your host, Simon Vetter. I believe that one of the most satisfying and rewarding moments in life is belonging to a trusted team and achieving something unique together. Thank you for joining our dialogue, how to build, lead, and be part of an inspired team and community. Our guest today, Carolyn Maui, is a successful entrepreneur and the author of her new book, Gourmet Leadership, Turn Up the Heat of Your Secret Sauce. Think of your recent gourmet dinner experience at your favorite restaurant. A cozy setting, delicious food, amazing service. Carolyn has explored all the ingredients that goes into this exquisite experience. The vision, the chef, the team, and everything else that is happening behind the scene. Enjoy the Teaming Up conversation with Carolyn Maui. Carolyn, I'm so excited for our conversations today. Let's dive into your new book. It's called Gourmet Leadership. What inspired you to write that book?
Well, I started to think about writing the book actually when I was relocating from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Florida. And I thought I need some kind of calling card to show what I can do and what my philosophy of coaching is. And so I started thinking about how I could describe my coaching process. And because of one of my interests in being so strong in food and cooking and restaurants, I started to think about that metaphor that I've already used in coaching, but I started to think about the coaching fundamentals that I use as ingredients. And so then I started to think about, wow, won't it be great if I can put all the things that I do with clients, assignments and exercises, if I could put it in one place, and then I can give it to clients and have them do the exercises in the book and read about my philosophy. And then as I started to write the book and I started to learn more about needs of coaching in our society and how so many people that could benefit from coaching don't get coaching. And so I thought, well, how can I use the book to help empower leaders to help mentor and develop the people that they work with? So it became a mechanism for discussing leadership competencies and skills that leaders can use themselves, but then they can also use it as a mechanism to teach and develop their direct reports.
I love the metaphor, cooking and the food. Let's address that in your personal life. You have a passion for food and cooking.
I do.
Can you give us a personal experience or an incident where you were creating an extraordinary gourmet meal for friends? And what did you cook? And how did that go about? And what was the result? Or what was the praise you got from your guests?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Well, I was thinking about a recent meal that I made. One of our favorites is roasted lamb. And so I made an asparagus tart with that. And then my family loves mashed potatoes, so I made homemade mashed potatoes. And then I made a mousse, a chocolate mousse. My favorite moment in a meal that I've cooked for people is when there's complete silence. People are just savoring the flavor and getting into the experience of eating. And that's what I experienced with this recent meal. Was people normally, you know, our family's talkative and we have grandchildren and they're talking and we're asking them questions. But there were moments where it was just complete silence and people were totally into the meal and the flavors. And I love that moment.
In your book, you talk about the secret sauce. Mm-hmm. And what is that magic of a chef's signature dish? Mm-hmm. What is the secret sauce in leadership?
The secret sauce of leadership is the interests and talents and special viewpoint that a leader brings to the world and to their team and to their work. It's something that sets them apart, that when used, it's like adding a special seasoning to a dish that makes their leadership unique. I feel like, as the book describes, there's two fundamentals to leadership. One is you have to have the right ingredients. You have to have the right fundamentals, because without those fundamentals, many leaders experience their leadership as Swiss cheese. You know, they have holes in their leadership that they just didn't learn, because we don't have any kind of way of standardly preparing leaders in our societies. Oftentimes leaders use strengths that they've developed or they inherited from their family, but there's some really important competencies of leadership that they haven't learned. These ingredients are about that, that there are fundamentals to leadership that good leaders have. And then on top of that, the other major fundamental is the secret sauce, which is, I mean, my belief and one of my passions is bringing out the uniqueness of each person and each leader. When a leader brings that special viewpoint and is not afraid to share their love of a particular interest, then it really just adds flavor and fun and interest to their relationship with their team and also just to the workday.
For the book, you interviewed different chefs, mm-hmm. different backgrounds across the nation. What is a chef that you interviewed that kind of stands out? Can you give me a couple of examples?
Sure. One of the chefs that I interviewed is Chef Neil Bailey, and he's a very experienced chef. He's now at a very high-end resort in Southern Florida. Interestingly, the story that he told was about the fact that while all leaders need to aspire to greatness and all people can aspire to greatness, interestingly, one of the things that he was most passionate about was a story he told of working with a Michelin star chef when they were opening a restaurant in Washington, D.C. His name was Chef Antoine Westerman. Neil talked about the experience of being taught by this very experienced, very magical chef. What Neil realized in that moment was most of the people in that room, including him, were never going to get to that point of excellence. They just were never going to be that good. But just being in his presence and hearing his philosophy and seeing his energy and his perfectionistic approach made them better.
Now, this chef, Antoine Westerman, obviously had a secret sauce. There are people who have this uniqueness, this talent, which we might not have. How do we find out our own secret sauce? How do we explore what makes us unique? What's your recommendation on that?
Well, first of all, I would say that it's important to be really reflective and honest with oneself about that. Many of us walk around with interests and talents that we kind of take for granted, or that we feel like there's a barrier between our personal life and our work life. And that if we have one of these passions, that it's not appropriate to bring it into the workplace. My philosophy about secret sauce really flies in the face of that. That is, people are drawn to the uniqueness of their leaders. They feel a bond with them when they understand that someone has a particular passion or a particular interest.
So going back to the chefs that you interviewed, when you are thinking about a chef being in a kitchen, what are some of the biggest challenges those chefs face in terms of creating this extraordinary experience and delicious meal to serve?
One of the chefs I interviewed is Chef Dominic Branzuzzi, and he runs a restaurant in Pittsburgh called Piccolo Forno. Basically, he learned the restaurant industry from his parents, who had their own restaurant when he was a child. And he learned the restaurant industry from them and from another mentor who had a successful business in the restaurant industry. And he went to college. And shortly after college, he opened his own restaurant. And he talked about how every day is different, and that basically what you've got to create with your employees is bringing a sense of calmness, a sense of stability and serenity, and letting them know that no matter what happens, it'll be okay, and that you're there for them, and that really that connection, that emotional connection of a sense of family, he called it, at the workplace, is so important in keeping the rhythm and the pace of the restaurant going.
So what's the challenge that he faces
what's kind of, sometimes it can be super demanding being in a kitchen and things fly around. And so what are some other challenges a chef has?
Well, he was also, you know, talking about the restaurant industry during and post COVID. I mean, one of the huge challenges was just staffing and knowing when to keep the restaurant open, how to continue to serve their customers through the pandemic. He became very innovative. They analyzed all of their offerings and they assessed which were the best sellers, and they limited their menu to the best sellers. And then they limited them to the days of the week where previously they had the highest volume of customers. And by doing that, by offering the customers favorite meals on the favorite nights, they were able to continue to flourish with a successful business. So it's that combination of having different things come at you every day that you're not prepared for, that high pace of expectation of turnaround of the food and the delivery of the food and the working with the purveyors and all of that. And then the challenges that come with running a business of, you know, being strategic, being smart about it and stepping outside the box, taking risks and being innovative.
Yeah. So one is the kind of strategic decisions to make sure you serve the dishes that people want.
Yeah.
And then the other one is creating that serenity, that family feel where people feel mm-hmm. supported and there is a sense of peace, even though it's very hectic.
Yeah. The other night, interestingly, here close to home, I was in a restaurant, our favorite Italian restaurant. I was waiting to pick up pizza and I was watching the chefs and the cooks in the kitchen. And, you know, sometimes when I work with leaders, I talk about how work is really a well-oiled machine, right? You've got to have the components in place. And, you know, I use, rather than a cooking metaphor, sometimes I use a car metaphor. You know, you can't drive half a car. You've got to have all of the pieces in place. And I was thinking about that as I watched these chefs and cooks the other night, because everyone was in their own little zone, like their own physical space. They clearly had their own repetitive things that they did. Like I was watching the guy pulling the pizzas out of the oven and putting new pizzas in the oven. And, you know, other people had different spaces and they were responsible for different things, salads and spaghetti and things like that. And so there was this sort of rhythm and very clearly defined roles. And yet they were having a blast. They were laughing. Mm. They were talking to the waitresses. They were talking to each other. And so it's like, they had the organizational skills to accomplish what needed to be accomplished. And when they had those in place, it freed up energy to have a fun, emotionally positive atmosphere. And so I think that combination of knowing what people's roles are, knowing what the job is, making sure people are trained to do it, when that goes more on autopilot, that frees up energy for people to have that sense of camaraderie that we really all crave, you know, we really want to have with each other.
You talk about the team environment, and mm-hmm. chef is kind of sets the tone. He needs people who really execute. What advice or what insights did you learn from those chefs? How you create this environment that is fun, that is high productive, that creates the ingredients and recipes? What did you learn? What are some insights?
Well, it's very interesting, Simon, that you're interviewing me about your team's philosophy, because what I found is that of the 9 chefs that I interviewed, and I interviewed them all and asked them all different kinds of questions about leadership and about their work and different aspects, ingredients of leadership. And so many of them talked about the most important thing being that sense of team, that and how you achieve that sense of team. And they talked about things like creating a sense of trust and putting their employees first. You know, one of the chefs is Sherry Goldstein from Square Cafe in Pittsburgh. And she talked about the fact that they hire for personality first and then skill later. And she said, because you have to have a certain kind of character and personality and style in order to work in that kind of high-paced restaurant. And she said, you know, if we hire correctly, we get people that are talented, but they're loyal, they're hardworking, they're selfless. They want to be part of a team. They want to give back to the community. They want to give back to their customers. And so the chefs to a person basically talked about how important it is for the chef themselves to instill that sense of commitment and commitment to each other, commitment to the community, commitment to their customers. If you don't have that, you're not going to have a successful business.
In that particular case, hiring for personality first, did he say anything about the process? How do you vet for that personality? Did he talk
about... She said she just interviewed a lot. She spent a lot of time in the interviewing, making sure that the fit was correct and that she spent a lot of time describing the actual atmosphere, the types of people that had been successful there, the types of characteristics that were successful. And she said, you know, there's some people that we realize in the interview process that it's not a good fit. But she also said that instilling those values and making those values very clear right from the beginning is also really important, because then people know what is expected of them and how really committed they need to be to the process, but then how satisfying that can be as well.
One of the challenges is finding the right people. And then once you have them, how you keep them. And the restaurant business is not an easy environment, and it's not the best paid environment. What are some of the learnings in terms of keeping good employees and keeping them engaged? And
one of my leaders that I interviewed is Mark Becker, and he worked as an executive chef for a corporation. And so he basically ran the catering and cafeteria services for this corporation. And, you know, he said that he learned a long time ago that you're only as good as your team, and that coworkers come in with different backgrounds and different educations. And he said, figuring out everyone's secret sauce, really, their gifts, what is their unique viewpoint? He said, you know, like, for example, there was one woman and she was just particularly good at customer interface at the beginning of the line. She said, you know, he said people would come in to the cafeteria and she'd be the first person that would greet them. And that was magic, because she set the tone for the rest of the process, right? And then he said there were other people that were so creative when it came to suggestions for expanding their menu, suggesting different kinds of ethnic foods, or, you know, really paying attention to what people liked. And so his philosophy was very much pay attention to what people are good at, and then really reinforce how important they are to you. Give them the opportunity to expand and grow. All of them talked about that it's so important to give people an opportunity to grow and show that you believe in them and show that you believe in their capabilities, and that they have opportunities to contribute even more than maybe what they were originally hired in for.
There is a lot of surveys done around strength, mm-hmm. that a strength is a good indicator and predictor for performance. And the strength is what people do really well, what they love to do. It's going back to your concept of the secret sauce. Mm-hmm. So it confirms that from those chefs, and that as a leader, it's really important to understand each individual secret sauce and how does it fit into the big picture.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And it's, again, philosophically with the book, and when I'm working with leaders and when leaders are reading the book and when I'm coaching leaders, I want them to be thinking about their secret sauce and to bring that forth. And I also want them to look for that secret sauce in the people that work for them and encourage that to come out, because that is really a very important retention tool, truly. I mean, it you know, if people feel understood and valued and seen as special, they're going to have a sense of loyalty and want to be part of that team.
What other concepts did you learn from the kitchen that can be translated into a company or a corporation?
Well, one of my favorite ones, but the very first chef I interviewed, her name is Allison Negrin, and she's had a varied career as a chef in a number of different capacities, including a stint at Chez Panisse in California. And she's been involved in developing food technology systems, but she's an artist by training. And when she was in college, she wasn't sure which direction to go, whether she should go in becoming a chef or whether she should continue to be an artist. And the concept that she talked about was truth to material and the truth of the material. And I think that relates so much to what we're talking about, right? Is if a leader can look at someone and see their raw potential, right? And see the opportunities there. Like she talked about being a sculptor and how, you know, she could see the image of what she wanted to sculpt, and then she would just chip away at the outside, right, to get to the sculpture. Like I think Michelangelo talked about that. And then she also talked about truth and material with cooking. You know, she talked about how important it was to get very important or very good organic ingredients and grass-fed beef. And so that if you have the truth to material in your ingredients, in your food preparation, naturally that is going to result in a delicious meal if you know how exactly to bring that out, right? And she said, because there's certain things that need to be braised, and there's certain things that need to be slow cooked, and there's certain things that need to be pan fried. And she said, the secret is like knowing the raw material and then how to bring that out. And I thought there were so many parallels to leadership in that metaphor.
I was in a whiskey, actually it's in the Guinness World Record. It's the smallest whiskey bar in the world. And it's a little town in Santa Maria in the Alps, in a side valley. And they make their own whiskey. And a few years back, they competed at a blind whisking competition in Scotland. And they won the competition they said, you know, they won because it's all about the quality of the ingredients. Mm-hmm. Yes. If you have really good ingredients, you can make the best whiskey. It doesn't have to be in Scotland. That's an interesting story that supports your point.
Absolutely. And I think it's a metaphor that we can carry in our leadership and across the board.
So what would be the ingredients? So one is the leader himself, what you mm-hmm. bring, what's your uniqueness, mm-hmm. the talents. And then how do you evaluate the ingredients or that in your people? What does it take to do that? What's the skill from your experience working in corporations that we can hone to really make sure we get the right ingredients?
Are you talking about like bringing out the secret sauce in individuals or
Yeah.
Well, I certainly think that it requires a shift in thinking about what is most important in being a leader. Because most leaders, at least in the Western world, are promoted because they were good individual contributors, right? They were expert at what they did, whether it's technology or medicine or teaching or whatever, manufacturing. You know, people historically anyway have gotten promoted because they were good at what they did in a technical sense. And we're still, I think, as a society, at least in the US, we are still moving from the industrial age to the knowledge age. And in so doing, we still have some residue beliefs about what's important in the workplace in terms of leading people. And it tends to fall back to thinking about the technical performance of the job, you know, making sure people are doing the right job in the right amount of time and perfectly. And, you know, what we're talking about here in bringing out people's individual gifts and retaining people as a result and building a team of expert, proficient people that churn out delicious meals or new technologies or new kinds of surgery. It really requires a leadership style that pays very close attention to the people that work for them and, you know, and really gets to know them, really understands them, understands what makes each individual person successful and motivated. And then creating also in the larger sense, creating a climate where that kind of understanding is held up as important and imperative. So it's not only doing it oneself, but it's creating the training and the structures for the management team, so, and the supervisors, so that they know also how to impart that sense of listening and knowing their people and being able to respond. Each one of my chefs talked about so much of their day is unplanned. You know, they think they're going to do, or restaurateurs anyway, they're going to do a certain amount of things and they do get those done. But there's always things that happen every day that's unplanned. And being able to stay calm, you know, have confidence in your team that they're going to be able to handle it, help them solve problems. I mean, it's really a shift into that servant leader mindset we talk about, but that is still really kind of in the infancy stages of implementing across the board, I think, in our world.
In other words, you still see that some of the thinking pattern is still around technical things, industrial type of output. Mm-hmm. And as we are clearly more in a knowledge-based work environment, we're still holding beliefs from the industrial age.
I believe so. I think that's one of the things we see. Do you see that in your work?
Yeah. Yeah. It's people say, hey, we need the person who has the best knowledge in this. And yes, you need that. But then also you don't focus on, okay, to your point, does that person fit in our team, in our culture? What would be your perspective? How do we accelerate that shift in mindset and shift in thinking pattern to upgrade our leadership mental model to the industrial, from the industrial-based corporation into a knowledge-based, service-oriented area? How we upgrade our mental model around right. leadership?
Well, I think we have to fall back to what we know is true about behavioral change, right? The first is to set the expectation and explain and educate leaders and managers and supervisors about the imperative need to make that shift. And you know, I think we're seeing it right before our eyes right now, right? With the great resignation, right? Where we have generations of people that are coming up that are going to demand a certain level of growth and development and advancement that if we don't figure out pretty quickly how to respond to those needs, we won't be able to retain the high quality talent that we want to retain. And so I think, first of all, it's educating. Then I think, secondly, it's catching people doing it well, right? I think it's not an all or nothing now. I think we see people being drawn to want to develop these skills and competencies. And so we have to help them identify when they're doing it well. And that part of that comes from also encouraging them to get feedback from the people that work with them and work for them so that they can get real-time feedback and how they're doing in their leadership and how people are feeling about working there and being in the culture. And then the third thing I think that's important is you have to figure out ways to help people learn this really quickly because workplaces are, the changes are happening so rapidly and that pace of change is only going to exponentially continue. Figuring out technological solutions to help people learn this and reinforce this learning and make it part of the culture, I think is also going to be part of the solution.
You mentioned three things to accelerate that shift. Educate, set expectations. Number two, catch people when they do something right. So really use praise, recognition, feedback, and then help them to learn quickly. Mm-hmm. Having worked with a lot of different companies as a coach, as a facilitator, does one organization or team that you work with stands out that does an extraordinary job? And what was the team and what did they do that made them unique and I call it high performing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually talk about this example in the book in my chapter called The Right Cookware, Developing a Great Team. It's about a leader and a team that were in a continuing care retirement community. And the boss contacted me initially because he had a team of about 10 people, directors. And, you know, they were in things like marketing and HR and nursing and housekeeping and dietary. And he said that they were basically driving him crazy because each person would come to him individually and talk about another person on the team and expect him to intervene and make the other person change their behavior. And he said, I'm just sick of it. I'm not doing it anymore. I need help. And so this was a continuing care community as part of a larger company. And at that time, the first year that I worked with them, they were second to the bottom in 9 different retirement communities across the country in terms of revenue and stability of the residents that live there. And so that was the other thing, is he knew that he really needed to bring the team needed to get better at what they were doing. And so we had our first retreat the first year, and we talked about the key elements of successful teams, you know, building trust, resolving conflict, commitment to the team, accountability to one another, having a dashboard. And so that first retreat, we had some really, really good, honest discussions about A, where the organization needed to go. And the leader made it very clear what his vision was and what the measurements were going to be. And we also talked about the barriers that were getting in the way of the team working together interdisciplinarily to achieve these goals. And there were some pretty heated conversations in that retreat. People were somewhat critical of each other, but what they agreed was that from then on, they were going to have quarterly meetings, and that if there were issues that they had with one another, they were going to go to one another first. And if they couldn't resolve it, then they were going to go to the boss. And that if there were bigger issues, they were going to put them on the agenda for the quarterly retreat. So I went back 5 years in a row, and I did the annual retreat with them, and we talked about the issues, and we did basically the same thing. And by the time we were finished after the 5th year, they were the second most productive community in the company. They were in terms of revenue and in terms of stability. And the team was functioning incredibly well. Also, there had to be some changes on the team, which the leader instituted. But they talked about, and then the leader said that having those annual retreats was the key to changing the way the team operated with each other and in becoming so much more successful, because it taught them how to talk more directly with each other and really work collaboratively together as one unit towards a common vision. And that's what they did.
So they had a platform, those regular meetings to really make the changes necessary on the team.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And so again, it's talking to each other, right? It's being direct with each other. It's getting clear on what the vision is, what the bogey is, how you're going to measure it, and how to solve problems together along the way. And I think that's really, in essence, what a good team does.
When you look back in your career, you have been part of many teams as a team member, as a leader. You also have an interest in music and classical music. Have you been on a team that stands out that was draining and just like better words to use, like horrible to be part of? And then what is a team that was an outstanding team that was just gelling? And can you think of a couple of sometimes we learn from the worst examples and then we strive for the best. So what are the two extremes in terms of your membership of teams?
That's a great question. So I'll talk about the negative experience first. I was on a board of a nonprofit organization. And shortly after I joined the board, it became clear that the CEO of the organization, it was a large nonprofit, that she just really wasn't doing her job. And there had been, the board then undertook having conversations with her to clarify the expectations. And there was literally no movement. I mean, she, for either because she couldn't or she wouldn't, that there was no change. And so in the meantime, the board was getting more and more complaints from the staff and the community. And ultimately we were able to move her out. But then there was the process of not having anyone in the position for a long time. And it was just really draining. It was just all negative. There was no growth. There was no, it was just problem solving one after another. And it was also seeing a leader who had, in my opinion, tremendous potential, but she just didn't exhibit leadership or work hard at her job. And that was really hard to watch for an organization that I cared about and was committed to.
It's also interesting that the board maybe didn't do the job well in terms of setting expectations and addressing the...
They had let it go on a very long time. And by the time I got on the board, it was blatantly obvious, but it had gone on for a long time. So yeah, so that was a bummer. I didn't like it. And I was glad to move off the board when my term ended. The best team that I've ever been on, I was in the employee assistance field for a long time, the EAP. And EAP is counseling services that companies provide to their employees for stress and addiction and family issues that can impact their work performance. And it also provides management training to managers and manager support. So I had been recruited to the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center after I had a leadership role in another organization. And when I got there, there were three employees and we were serving about 10,000 employee households in the hospitals of the system. And in the 10 years that I had the leadership role, we grew from three employees to 21. We grew from serving 10,000 households to over 100,000. And we served both the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center employees, and we also took the program to market and sold it to other companies in the region. And we became the largest EAP provider in the region. And we also did that with really high quality standards. I'm really proud of what we did as an organization. We helped a lot. We helped thousands of people a year keep their jobs and get mental health services when needed. And also we had a really good time. We just had a great team of people. And I look back on it now and I think of all the people we interviewed and all the people we hired and we onboarded them. Everybody just kind of joined the group and performed at this really high level. And there was a tremendous amount of learning going on. I mean, none of us knew anything about marketing and sales. And I had to learn that and found out I liked it. It wasn't like we didn't have any problems or concerns. And plus we were doing hard work, but I look back on it and it was really fun. And I think it was because there was a sense of mission. We knew what our mission was. We were helping people. Secondly, we knew what our bogey was. We knew how many people we needed to serve a year, and we figured out how to do that. We figured out how to sell it, and we sold it. And we were doing really interesting work. But we also would do stuff like we had a monthly potluck lunch, you know, and then we would celebrate everybody's birthdays, and we celebrated holidays and decorated and always had candy. And it was just, we moved a bunch of times and we just kind of picked up and moved where we needed to go. And it was really, really rewarding. And I've talked to people on the team since then. And this was back in the 90s and early 2000s. And people talk about it, that it was the best team they've ever been on.
So purposeful, fun, mm-hmm. and a good level of interaction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you had an advertisement that pops up on people's computers on a regular basis, what would you put on that advertisement that people need to know?
For themselves or for my book?
For themselves.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I was just reading the book Atomic Habits. We're reading that for our book group. And it gave an example of a company that periodically would, I don't remember how it was triggered, but if somebody did something well, there was like a high five that came up on their computer. It was like, you know, and I love that idea. I don't know technically how you would do that, but I think it just speaks to the message of, I think we could catch people in doing things right so much more than we do. And we can bring out those aspects of people. I mean, one of the words I use when I talk about secret sauce is oftentimes secret sauce is sort of whimsical. You know, it's just a little bit, it's just a little bit creative. It's a little bit different. It's a little bit magical. And again, we don't historically think of those words in association with work, but you know, it's the spice, it's the fun. And, you know, when we can bring that out in people, and then when we can also catch people doing things well and really genuinely thank them and show our appreciation for them in the moment, I think that's what I would want to say is, you know, catch people doing things right.
Good. Thank you. Where can people find about the book and learn more about you?
They can find me at the Maui Center, which is MAUECENTER.com. They can also find me, Carolyn Maui, on LinkedIn and on Facebook. Those are the best places for now. We are getting a gourmet leadership website up and going. So if you write to me at either one of those places, I'll make sure we get you on the mailing list for that website.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's been a great pleasure learning from your experience. Thank you.
Thank you. It was wonderful talking with you, Simon. Best wishes with your podcast.
Thank you. Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.